What if Fitwear fought Bruce Lee? In honor of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, what's your favorite moment in a movie where a character from real life shows up?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm sorry. I don't know why this is what came into my mind. I don't like this movie, but Liza Minnelli singing Single Ladies at the beginning of Sex and the City 2 is memorable.
I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with Jean-Claude Van Damme, the entire movie, JCVD. Maybe specifically when he floats into the sky and delivers a monologue about his career.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven, and back in the day, John Malkovich, being the type of character and being John Malkovich as he is, blew my mind and made me think that for like a while, if you wrote a good enough movie for a person, they'd just be in it.
That might be true.
I'm David Ehrlich. I have a vague memory of doing this question before, but after 500 or so episodes, who could blame us for repeating ourselves? Either way, I, as much as I want to go with our cartoon president in Home Alone 2, Escape
Favorite?
From New York, I want to go with my default answer for this question is Kurt Vonnegut in Back to School, who Rodney Dangerfield pays to write an essay about Kurt Vonnegut. And he gets a D, and it's funny.
Because it's Kurt Vonnegut.
Mm-hmm. I was listening to some Kurt Vonnegut Shape of Story video essays the other day.
Okay. And did Kurt Vonnegut show up?
I mean, yeah, he's narrating it, but it's like a lecture they showed us in screenplay school, and then I tried to paraphrase it after watching Wild Rose, and it did not work.
Great Wild Rose shout out. Also, that lecture is a part of This American Life episode that came out or was re-aired recently. They go into it in great detail, which is surprising. They also framed the whole episode with Aerith's death in Final Fantasy VII, which was unexpected, but that's neither here nor there. We're talking about this podcast now.
Gotta get back on This American Life.
Oh, fuck yeah, I listened to that part and then didn't finish the episode.
I don't trust Ira Glass. He's a shifty character. I don't know why.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, then, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Welcome to Fighting in the War Room, episode 266, and it is the week of Wednesday, July 24th. On that day, 1969, an event that has really kept my attention for the last week. It was when Apollo 11 re-entered the Earth's atmosphere after successfully landing on the moon. I think.
Oh, you've been rewatching From Earth to the Moon?
I've been. I watched a bunch of Smithsonian Channel documentaries about the moon landing on Saturday night, which was the night of the anniversary. And I followed a Twitter feed that just live tweeted all of the like transcripts of the conversations between them and Houston. It was fascinating.
Oh, I just watched For All Mankind on the Criterion Channel. We're all getting moon content.
Moon stuff. Yeah.
There's a ton of fucking moon podcasts.
What'd you say, David?
Mooncast. I have a take that I got to from you talking about a Tom Hanks related project that I feel like you're going to be my polar opposite on, which is that, and well, you can revisit this in a couple months, that the Mr. Rogers movie looks real bad.
Wait,
but it's going to be a ton of money.
Hang
on. We're going to be revisiting this in the mini segment for
listen,
the show.
Yeah, we got time for this.
Tom Hanks is
all
the
way back to Earth.
Of the moon.
Is that your review for the podcast for this episode?
We will give you time to shit on Tom Hanks. David, in the meantime, do we have reviews?
Listen. No one needs to shit on Tom Hanks, unless
I mean people.
Want to, I'm sure they would pay for the pleasure. and listen, I'm not here to judge. If that's what he's into, then so be it. We have several reviews, and let's start with one of them. Little Fat Kids says thumbs up. I wanted to write a clever review to get everyone to laugh, but there's just too much pressure. So instead, I'll say how great you all are, and it's always a highlight of my week. Keep up the good work. Is this review helpful? Yes. And it also, I think, it made me chortle, if not full on laugh, by the username alone. Even before they got to the anxiety-ridden review, we had already laughed. So think about that. Eric of Columbus says, thank you from Columbus. really enjoy the free-form approach to this podcast. You guys are all genuinely fun to listen to. I was hoping to get some more insight as to why you guys prefer the platform release structure for smaller non-studio films. At least this is the impression I get from you from all previous episodes. Being from Columbus, Ohio, a growing progressive city, go Blue Jackets, that's my editorial insertion, not his, or theirs, or his, Eric.
It's what are the Blue Jackets? Hockey? Is this hockey?
God damn it, Katie.
It's the opposite
they
of
are a proud NHL team. And the New York Rangers just stole or, you know, signed one of the best players, Terry Panarin, the bread man.
What?
It's all happening. Anyway, okay. Go ahead.
Do we prefer platform releases?
Wait.
I am reading the review. What happened? Something happened. Okay, this review is really going to be a test of Dave's editing prowess.
But do you want to just start this guy's review again? And
no.
How am I going to fake my reaction to the hockey thing?
Speech about the bread man. I'm not starting over. Meanwhile, when we last left off with Prince Valiant, he was complaining about how people in Columbus get movies weeks or months after Film Twitter has digested them. For instance, he says, I've been dying to catch The Farewell, but it won't arrive till early August here. Call Me By Your Name didn't reach Columbus until February of 2018. The question I want to ask is, if you believe the platform release is necessary to build word of mouth for these kinds of films in the age of social media, or could it possibly be more effective to release them in most cities at once and slowly expand the number of screens they're presented on in those cities? Curious of your thoughts. Anyway, love you guys. Keep doing what you're doing. Eric from Columbus. Was this review helpful? It was hard for us to get through for technical reasons, but it was helpful because it gave us an opportunity to just reiterate that, unfortunately, Eric, while I know it must be frustrating, and I mean this sincerely, to read about films that are going to take a while to get to, that
David will not be shaking his elitism anytime soon, and you can go fuck yourself and live in New York,
exactly.
According to Dave.
No, that FOMO is the marketing strategy in action. It would cost these small distributors too much money to keep the movies on screen, even if on fewer screens. They're already not playing on many for long periods of time. So you need that word of mouth to build. You need to see which of the movies are going to hold water. It's all very flexible and by the seat of their pants how they choose to expand these films, where they play them, on how many screens, and so on. It depends on the reaction they get in the major cities. It's sort of the nature of the beast. Maybe there is a better way that somebody hasn't thought of yet. But for the time being, I think this is going to be it. This is why you're champing at the bit to see The Farewell, is because of all the chatter you've seen thus far. I'm very sorry. I hope these movies aren't spoiled for you by the time they get there. But I mean,
we're the show for him because we got two people on here who don't live in major markets. I mean, Denver gets movies faster than I do. Farewell has not played here yet. I have not yet gotten to see it. Also, I went to Columbus for the first time earlier this year. It's lovely. I don't know anything about hockey.
You left the city without even knowing that they were home to the mighty Columbus Blue Jackets, a playoff-worthy team.
I usually ask that the minute I cross into a city limits.
Is it basically accepted now that Booksmart is like the cautionary tale from this year of why not to just suddenly release your small movie to a whole bunch of theaters, good buzz?
But to a detrimental degree. I think that people are overly reading into Booksmart. Which is a movie that was kind of bungled in its release in a number of different ways. But yes, to answer your question, it really has been looked at as a bellwether for how to proceed. But the amount of money that, I mean, The Farewell is kind of a unicorn, or so it feels, and people are going to look for how to replicate it. Quality goes a long way, I should say. But the amount of money that The Farewell is making per screen on like Monday nights right now is bonkers. So I'm really interested in seeing how that expansion continues. Anyway, Plushes says David Ehrlich is my hero. Hey, David Ehrlich is great. I gave him 1,000 stars. That's a lot of stars. iTunes can only accommodate 5, so many of them are wasted, but I appreciate it all the same. It's totally awesome. What's that?
I said that's more than Mario has.
Yeah, I mean, there's only like in the latest Mario game, there are like only a couple hundred, right? I didn't even come close to getting them all, but I was just right. It was moons. Stars is
give David moons.
Give me moons. I want them moons, baby. From the earth to the moons. It's totally awesome to hear opinions different from your own. It's totally awesome to not get mad at someone over their opinions. Maybe we are not the right show for you. Everyone else is also great. Was this review helpful? Very. Thank you for listening, Plushist. Finally, we have Pete the Engine Nerd. We actually read Pete the Engine Nerd's review recently. I think as recently as last week, when Pete complained about me. I had a different take than Plushist, but you know, we're all not mad at each other as per Plushist review. He also spelled my name incorrectly every time, even though it's written all over the internet. But then he updated his review, which we all appreciate very much, to 5 stars from one little score, and said, "Updated to 5 stars to reflect my real opinion of the podcast now that I know you read it."
That's awesome.
And you know what, Pete? I totally get that. Just sometimes you just want to be validated, you know? It's like if someone out there is going to read what you have to say, follow you on the internet, you're likely to be a lot, a lot more forgiving.
We will read whatever you put in the iTunes store, so use your power wisely.
It is true. Please do leave us a review. We will try to get through them with fewer technical difficulties. Our apologies to Eric of Columbus, although thank you for your review. On iTunes, Fighting in the War Room. On with the show.
Hey, David, you worked really hard on something that is on the internet now. I'm a little personally offended by it because I think it's way too early for the end of decade content minds to start employing all of us. But you seem pretty proud of yourself. So why did you rank the 100 best films of the decade already in July?
I'm curious to hear you frame it that way.
It's unnecessarily hostile.
I would say
it is a beautiful
stress.
Package.
Stress is the emotion that I'm feeling more than anything else right now. The stress of putting this, our 100 best films of the decade and related content package together over at IndieWire and continuing to do so even as we record this. The stress of dealing with some of the reactions to it, the most common of which was invariably, why are you doing this so early? There are answers to that question that are not super interesting. I think there are more interesting answers to that question. I mean, that have to do with like the logistics of the internet, and it's sort of very much like a don't hate the player, hate the game sort of mentality, unfortunately. But there are also other questions, other answers to that question, which are a little bit more abstractly interesting. Like, you know, in 6 months from now, sure, maybe we'll have seen Uncut Gems. It'll be wonderful. Or Cats, which I think you and I both agree should have a spot reserved for it on this list.
Certainly.
But the fact of the matter is that, you know, what the best of the decade is now versus 20 films from now, few of which might merit inclusion. It's kind of a minor difference. We've been sitting on these movies for 9.5 years. I think that what the movies we remember 10 years from now is going to be a lot more significant than the movies in the way that it shakes out in 4 or 5 months from now. And then, of course, there's reality of just not stepping on the toes of our year-end coverage in December and wanting to get out ahead of this. And because this is sort of a dead time in the year, even though August may have been even better, what with all the Quentin Tarantino stuff right now.
Clear way for Star Wars on IndieWire.com.
Well, no, it's just like all of our year-end stuff. You know, anyway, you know, and it's good to set the table. I mean, there's no stopping anyone else and everyone else, I'm sure, from doing the same later on. But someone had to be first. I'm fine with it being us. And I get to go on vacation next week, so... that's really all that matters to me. But no, I am proud of the package that me and my team put together. I'm especially happy with all of the fun supplementary material we have. We have great retrospective interviews with Barry Jenkins, who in Moonlight was our number one film, with Joshua Oppenheimer, who made The Act of Killing and The Look of Silence, with George Miller, who was talking about Fury Road and how he met babies named Furiosa, and a Japanese film critic who ripped open his shirt to reveal a giant tattoo that he got right after walking out of the movie theater, and talked about how confident he is that his Furiosa sequel and another sequel are actually going to happen. We have interviews with Sarah Polley and Ezra Edelman and maybe some other people. So it's fun. But Katie, what exactly about this did you want to talk about? Do you want to get into the
I guess mostly the logistics of how you guys put something like this together. Like, I think having known you a long time, having listened to you talk about a lot of these films on this podcast, I see something like Certified Copy at number 3. And I'm like, okay, well, David put his thumb on the scale for that one. But was there like how much consensus did you guys find? Like how much did you battle with the top 10 maybe as a place to start?
There's a quote that Tom York used to say about the power dynamics in Radiohead, where he was like, we're like the United Nations, but I'm America. And that's sort of how I took to this. I have a great respect for the people that I work with at IndieWire, but we went into this with the understanding of like, I am putting this together. I want, and I actively, over a long process, solicited their opinions on every part of the package that we put together. But I made it clear that this was not going to be the way that we typically do lists, where it's just a mathematical process and we average out the numbers and that's our list. I was always the plan that I was going to curate this to reflect, to the best of my critical capability, the movies that I thought, you know, within the parameters of the movies that people had voted for. So not just going super esoteric and putting like three Wang Bing documentaries on there because I wanted to, like within the parameters of what IndieWire's employees felt, organizing the movies and prioritizing them in a way that I thought would look good in the long run. And would respect the films. There are a
this
lot
is
of
definitely films. Your list. I mean, I'm looking at it right.
Yeah. I mean,
now,
there are films on there that I actively loathe. I hate Beasts of the Southern Wild. I tried to put it as low as humanly possible.
That was going to be my one substitution on this list. Is I like this list, and I've seen more of the movies than I thought I would have when you were saying you were going to do, you know, a top 100 of the decade. But I would have said sub in Swiss Army Man for Beasts of the Southern Wild.
What a trade. I mean,
there are so many, but you know, that was Beast of the Southern Wild was number one on somebody's ballot, and so it had to be on the list.
What's the movie that's gotten the most like pushback that you've heard the most about that people are surprised to see? I see there's no pop star on this list, so I'm a little
That actually has not come up. You know, there has been some chatter. I mean, listen, you make these lists, and especially if you're going to have the audacity to put it out in late July, best of the decade list. And this is something that I've sort of inured myself to. If I put my best of the year list out in the very beginning of December every year, and there are a lot of people who don't understand how our industry works and always like, it's not the end of the year, you know, not knowing that we've seen all the movies. In this case, we haven't seen all the movies, but I'm sort of a nerd to that sort of criticism. But there has been talk about you know, people complaining that like The Great Gatsby is on the list, for example, which I just wanted to throw as a curveball at the start of it. Or like The Last Jedi, of course, which I was happy to bait people with on Twitter, even though I'm very happy that the movie's on the list. But, you know, the of course what happens more often than not is that people complain about the movies that are not on lists like this. And overwhelmingly, as much as like some pockets, like you can't, you know, we almost surgically pissed off both like the normie people and also the very sort of aggro film bro types, you know, but in the former camp, far and away the most common complaint was the absence of Denis Villeneuve films. I would say on Twitter,
which one?
Every
Runner.
Now somebody
Arrival, Blade Runner 2049, Prisoners. He has a more vocal fan base than
Arrival is the one. If I can see making the case for Arrival,
I thought Arrival was pretty underwhelming, and I like his films. I think they're all just like pretty good. I think Blade Runner is one of his best, and I still wouldn't put it on this list.
Prisoners is a nightmare, so take that.
I have to say that his name or any of his films did not come up a single time in any of our conversations about putting this list together. And for every comment we got about some other movie, we must have gotten three about a Denis Villeneuve omission. You know, from the film bro side of things, one guy was going off about the lack of Chinese movies, which, you know, if I had my druthers, it's definitely, I mean, that's something that I definitely wish that I could have corrected. We did have Black Coal Thin Ice. Black Coal Thin Ice was the closest. But there are so many great Chinese films from this decade. The nature of doing a group list where not everyone is like,
you can always throw your collaborators under the bus.
Yeah, well, no, but it's like, you know, not everyone is on the film festival circuit. And a lot of these films didn't really get much of a release. And so it does sort of gravitate towards the norm. The IndieWire brand is what it is. I think it's a really healthy and effective brand that draws. Like, I always loved that a movie like Happy Hour, which is a 5.5-hour Ryunosuke Hamanaguchi film, is like number 95 or 94 on the list. It's one of the first things that people saw. And, you know, so many people read this package, and all those people, some of them scrolled right over it, but a number of them, and I have the data to prove it, spent time reading about this 5.5 hour Japanese film that is now available to stream online. But it's like, yeah, I wish that it could have represented on some more esoteric films that people would, you know, who
I
are
think you did an okay job for
yeah. Wire would love to lambast. But like, well, you can never please anyway. But like, it was really cool for me that so many people that would never have otherwise engaged with a movie like that could see it, you know, next to Inherent Vice, and then next to a more obscure film like The Arbor, and then next to A Star Is Born, and so on.
I have been scrolling through the list slowly because for some reason it's loading slowly on my computer. This is probably my computer's fault.
This is every computer. It's a gigantic list.
It's a gigantic list. No, the higher, I just now realized how highly ranked A Ghost Story is, which thrills me. Like there's a lot of curveballs in there like that, which I don't know. I feel like you've been getting Villeneuve fans yelling at you this whole time, so maybe you don't feel as good about it. But like that's the fun of making a list like this. You want to get people yelling.
I think. For me, the big thing about thinking about the decade is what is the when you put a list like this together, is there any themes that form? Was there any messaging emerging from the films of this past decade? What was this past decade all about if we size it up from the macro of your list?
I mean, I don't think that the answer to that would be all that surprising, or the answers to that. In my little intro, which was sort of a fool's errand trying to sum up 10 years of film in like 200 words or whatever it is. I sort of harped on the notion that movies mean more things to more people now than they ever have before. I mean, like what a movie is, what a movie should be, what a movie can be. These are things that I think we used to have very streamlined definitions of, and now it's as multifaceted as the movies themselves and the people watching them. And that is something I think you definitely see reflected both in the movies of the decade and on the movies on this list. I think more obvious themes definitely include liberty, a response to fascism, you know, representation across the board. You know, you have a movie like Paddington 2 that's high on the list. You have movies about what identity means, like on film, less in a representative way and more just in terms of like screen images and the veracity and what the performative nature of being on screen. I think that speaks to Certified Copy in its place. Masculinity is definitely a recurring theme. You see that in Moonlight, which felt like a really it was a real consensus number one pick for us. I think that it's an important movie. It's something that I think is a landmark in several reasons, even before its Oscar success. It's a reminder that a $1.5 million budgeted movie can change the world, even in this day and age. It's a beautifully crafted object.
Was Moonlight an easy pick for number one?
Yeah. Moonlight was a really easy pick for number one. Under the Skin, number two, felt a little bit more like a crapshoot. Certified Copy, number three, was definitely me pushing it through. I do think that beyond IndieWire, Inside Llewyn Davis has really been lifted up towards the top of the Coen's filmography. So I wasn't surprised to see that too high on the list. You know, I do think The Wolf of Wall Street is going to join Goodfellas, Mean Streets, and whatever else people love for Raging Bull at the very top of Scorsese's list as time goes on. Paul Thomas Anderson had three movies on the list, which is more than anyone else. The Master was in the top 10, as was Fury Road, which was not his, of course. But I wonder if Phantom Thread might climb even higher as the years go by. But yeah, it was fun putting it together.
I'm curious, and I know that like there will be many other end of decade lists that come. I'm just curious about what the consensus favorite is going to wind up being. I'm not like, I think it could easily be Moonlight. I think my automatic thought when I'm like asked to like, what is the film of the decade? I think of The Social Network, but I don't know if other people are going to go that direction. I'm very curious about how much this winds up lining up with what people do later in the year.
Social Network will definitely come up a lot.
Social Network was lower ranked than I expected on this list.
It's in the top 20. I think The Tree of Life will be in the number one spot in a lot of places. That was only in our top 20, not our top 10. We had Leviathan up there, the documentary, not the Russian film. We had The Look of Silence and The Act of Killing. We had sharing the number four spot. I think those will be up there a lot. I do think that'll be interesting to see what some of the consensus takes are. I do think the IndieWire list will probably end up splitting the difference between like the super mainstreamy lists and the very sort of hardcore film commenty type lists. I'll be curious to see how it all shakes out. I do look forward to, because the internet, you know, despite what they say in the Social Network, you know, the internet is written in pen, not it's written in ink or pen, whatever the fuck in the line is.
Ink.
We can go back after the rest of this year. And if Cats really is as great as everyone knows it in its bones, it will be, mm-hmm. we can edit it into the list. But we'll see what happens.
For Daniel Radcliffe's boner.
What's at number 100 and in danger of getting kicked out by Cats?
I mean, Inherent Vice is at number 100, but
Paul Thomas Anderson, he can deal.
No, well, the way that a project like this works, I would not guarantee that it's just as simple as knocking everything up a spot. I think there's a structure to these things. And that might not be the movie that goes. But we'll see.
I want Paul Thomas Anderson and Cats to be in a feud. So just let me go with this.
Paul Thomas Anderson is going to love Cats. If anyone does, it's going to be PTA.
Okay, so we just talked about the last decade of movies. And one of the movies that David left off because he just didn't think they'd be good enough. Everything playing at the Toronto International Film Festival 2019.
I said.
Katie, since this is our mini segment for tonight, you know, they released a bunch of the big premiere gala screenings at TIFF, kind of sets the tone for your world, the award conversation. We're back at it, baby. I'm just curious if anything is standing out to you now. Like, what is heating up? I actually, because I am in a vortex of Comic-Con and raising a child, I have absolutely no idea what is emerging from the field this year, what people are really excited about and what has promised. It seems like Netflix has a lot going on.
I feel like it's hard to tell when you see the lineup, like which ones of these are Netflix movies. I can never remember. I know that The Irishman's a Netflix movie and it's not on here.
Is a Netflix movie. The Marriage Story.
Sure. Yep. That one.
Which is a Netflix movie and which is merely going to become a Netflix movie when they inevitably buy it.
Stamped.
Sure. Yes. Yeah. I'm definitely less able to kind of process the like Netflix versus everybody else of it all and just kind of look at individual titles and what seemed interesting. I'm super psyched that Hustlers is going to be there. That trailer dropped last week. It's Lorraine Scafaria's movie. It's got J-Lo as leading a ring of
stars. Very important. The cinematographer of Hustlers, and I'm not sure if Dave Gonzalez knows this, is the cinematographer who shot Fighting in the War Room classic film Proposals.
That's
produced
awesome.
By Dave Gonzalez. Todd Von Hazel, very, very talented, very nice guy, has been shooting great stuff for years and is the cinematographer on Hustlers, which looks awesome.
Love thinking of Todd telling J-Lo where to stand to get money to fall on her correctly. I'm glad he got to live that dream.
Congratulations to Todd. Iris Sachs has a movie that I think was at Cannes, but I haven't gotten to see it, so I'm excited.
Frankie, it's that. Okay.
Oh, all right. All right. Let's just stop bringing up things that you already know about. I'm raising a big eyebrow to Dolemite is My Name, which is like a biopic with Eddie Murphy. And the idea being that if Eddie Murphy comes back and tries, like people will care about him again. I am curious about the possibility of that, but other people seem excited for that. And I am getting my hopes up for The Friend from Gabriella Cowperthwaite, who's kind of she's directed Blackfish, is not that tested as a feature director, but it's based on this Esquire article that is completely heartbreaking about a husband and wife, and the wife is dying and their best friend moves in with them. Then the relationship's
I was at Esquire when we published that.
It's a great story. And, it stars my problematic fave Casey Affleck and Jason Segel, who I've been wondering what he's up to. So I'm planting my flag on that one, even though I might wind up regretting it. David, what do you actually want to see and not just shit on Tom Hanks?
I love Tom Hanks. I just, that movie, I don't know, man.
Mariel Heller has earned the right of the benefit of the doubt.
Mariel Heller is 0-2 for me, and this movie, I don't know. But we'll see. I want to love it.
She's 0-2?
I was not a fan of either of her films. I know. I'm in the extreme minority on that. So
It's good for you to stay quiet about this.
Yeah. No. I don't feel like a particular animus against her. Like a need to take her down.
Can You Ever Forgive Me? On my top 10.
Right. I like a lot. No, that movie is worse. But I like a lot, like about, I like what those movies are about, especially Can You Forgive Me? But they just didn't really work for me. Who knows
okay.
why? Anyway.
Okay, what do you want to see?
But I am really excited for Uncut Gems, the Safdie Brothers movie with Adam Sandler. Adam Sandler in actual actor mode is always exciting one way or the other. What else? I mean, there are so many, as there always are in Toronto. I hear
about
that
Armando Iannucci, David Copperfield movie with Dev Patel.
Sure. Why not? Is it going to be in the style of Death of Stalin?
I hope so.
Everyone's just going to be like, fuck you, Copperfield.
I mean, I have a hard time imagining Iannucci making a movie without profanity, so probably.
Yeah, I sure hope so. I hear from multiple anonymous sources that Noah Baumbach's movie is the best thing that he has ever made, a marriage story. That is a Netflix movie through and through, even though Noah Baumbach avowed to never work for Netflix again. But I guess Scott Rudin wields great power. But I hear that that is really wonderful. So, and I think a lot of these movies will probably show up in Venice slightly before Toronto. I hope so. I'm going to be in Venice the first time. What else is playing in Toronto? So much. I mean, like at Astra, did they not announce today? That'll
no.
That'll
I hope so. How to Build a Girl, the adaptation of the Caitlin Moran memoir that stars Beanie Feldstein. We stand Beanie Feldstein.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that sounds good.
I keep picking shit and stuff that you're just like, yeah, all right, you can like that if you want to.
Well, I did just publish our Best of Decade list, so it's like new movies, whatever. Patches, what jumped out of you?
Well, I'm excited for other people to see Shia LaBeouf's movie, Honey Boy, which I was kind of in the minority and really liking. I thought he was great in telling his own story and playing his own dad and being a total a-hole. I wonder if he'll be able to kind of ramp up some awards buzz around that. What else am I excited? I mean, I have a lot to catch up on from the holdovers from Cannes, of course. I feel like there are more than usual.
Let's not go into that whole thing. We already have that on the record.
Oh. I want to see Parasite. There we go. I can pick something that David likes.
Well, there you go.
Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
I want to see that too.
Oh, all right, Dave. Yeah. Let's get on the record, if we haven't already, your thoughts on the Joker. Or Joker.
Joker.
Knowing what I think I know about it from people that read the script, it could be a very good movie, but it's going to be very bad for fandom. So...
Yes,
wait, like it's not bad for have fandom, any... good for the rest of us, or like just they will make it bad for everybody.
They will make it bad for everybody.
Why will they make it bad for everybody? Well, they will, but
because every time there's a new Joker introduced on film, it doesn't matter if it's good or bad. They latch on to the worst parts of it on film, and from what I think this story is, it has a lot of good things to say about like male toxicity. But I think like Fight Club before it might be misinterpreted by people who are just like, ooh, new Joker movie.
Yeah,
this is a depressing way to think about a movie.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't trust Todd Phillips.
I also, I really want to see.
Jojo Rabbit.
I'm not that.
Knives Out.
I want to see Knives Out. And I'll tell you why I want to see Knives Out. I want to express some
healthy...
Because
it's finally a movie adapted from a Radiohead song.
No, please, let me speak. I want to express some healthy skepticism about Knives Out. I don't think Rian Johnson's ever made a great movie. And I'm like waiting for it to happen. And I hope that I've been watching a lot of Murder, She Wrote again recently, as I said previously on the podcast.
You not watching a lot of Murder, She Wrote, though?
Wait.
For the last 2 years,
Follow-up question. If Rian Johnson had never made a great movie, then why was The Last Jedi number 74 on IndieWire's list of the 100 best films of the decade?
I mean, that was one of my follow-up questions. It sounds like, do you hate, like, Brick and Brothers Bloom and Looper, which is, like, maybe not great movies.
He just said that he had made a great movie, and you just backed him up. They're not great movies.
Yeah,
I'm with you, Patrick.
Thank you. You agree with me. But yeah, I'm waiting for him to be firing on all cylinders. I feel like Knives Out is really personal for him. Then again, the movies that I didn't really love of his seem really personal to him. So I'm still really excited for like an Agatha Christie type whodunit. And it looks zany, but it could be too zany. Who knows? I just see so much like love for this movie already that I want to express some healthy skepticism.
Why also do you hate Jojo Rabbit and by extension Jews?
I do. You hate Jews, remember? Oh wait, did that make the podcast?
We don't know yet.
Oh boy.
Yeah, so Taika Waititi movie with the imaginary Hitler. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think we need to loop back to that.
Yeah, I just wonder if the gimmick is going to be, I don't know. I'm like afraid to enjoy this movie. I got to be honest. I wonder if it's a minefield.
What was the last movie that you saw in theaters and you were like, this is too goofy for me?
Ooh, good question.
Yeah, you do have a high tolerance.
You have a high tolerance for goofy, which
goofiness.
Well, he just said that
what Patches is worried about.
Well, no, I mean, but he's in between the two movies he just talked about. He said like one could be too goofy, and the other one could be like not goofy enough to work as a premise, maybe. So I'm just trying to figure out where this bar is.
Maybe goofy is the wrong word, and quirky is actually the word, because I don't love all of Taika Waititi's movies either. Ragnarok was really like, as I've described it before, Soma, and I really depreciate it in my mind. I love What We Do in the Shadows, perfect. Hunt for the Wildebeest, like it a lot, but I don't care for like Eagle versus Shark and that kind of thing. So I don't know
what
where
was
to.
I've first watched, movies I ever reviewed. Eagle
I'm
versus
not convinced.
Shark.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Out of Sundance?
No. Or, oh no, when I was working at Film Journal. That's oh right, yeah. Forever ago.
Yeah, I'm not convinced of Taika's like holiness yet, as many
oh,
on the internet
God.
Have, but.
I'm looking excited. Over the list now, and I see that Joker is listed as a North American premiere, which means that Joker, a Todd Phillips movie about the Joker, is premiering at Venice.
Oh, yeah. My we God. Talked about this on Little Gold Men, and the idea that Joker is going to follow the exact release pattern of A Star is Born, which played Venice and then Toronto and opened the first weekend in October. It is, it's a template. We'll see.
Yeah, you could just switch out two completely different movies. That sounds like...
yeah, it's fine.
I maybe it's just because I... I'm Jewish and the grandson of a Holocaust survivor and have grown up, you know, sort of around Holocaust jokes, which I can be a touchy subject on the internet, but not in a certain streak anyway. Always a touchy subject in Jewish families. Jojo Rabbit does not strike me as a sticky wicket. It just strikes me as a really...
What about Joker? Will that be good for the Jews?
No, Joker is not going to be good for humans. No one. But we will see. But... Makoto Shinkai, the director of Your Name, has a new movie, which is going to be, it looks like, at Venice also, called Weathering With You, which that's exciting.
Yeah.
Also,
I want to make, can I say one more? Can
yes,
we close that? I am excited to see what Steven Soderbergh does with Meryl Streep in The Laundromat. Like the idea of her being in a Panama Papers movie after the Pentagon Papers is kind of a snooze, but like Soderbergh's direction is not something I think of as being compatible with Meryl Streep's acting style. And I
really
want to see them intersect because she does like accents and mannered things and like transformations. And I'm like, Soderbergh is so like clean and, you know, Magic Mike style, like getting everybody in a room. I don't know. I don't think of them
that
as.
That doesn't compute to me at all. I feel really, like all of his movies have super heightened, super theatrical at times. I'm thinking
they,
of
they
everything.
Can,
from
like The Informant.
Contagion, to.
I just think it's interesting that Meryl Streep is playing the same character she played in Big Little Lies in this movie about the Panama Papers.
Well, here's the interesting thing to go off on that and the latest episode of Still Watching Big Little Lies, a Vanity Fair podcast. One of the actresses who was with Meryl Streep in the court scene says that she would tell whoever was directing her if they asked questions about her character that it was none of their business. And
wow.
That like Meryl Streep just sort of like builds this character and then shows up to perform it. So I think I was slightly more on Katie's side in terms of that doesn't seem like the Soderbergh method, but I don't think that's something that is incompatible with that method.
No, I mean, I think Steven Soderbergh can do literally anything. I'm very interested to see what kind of performance he gets from Meryl Streep.
For sure.
I'm also excited for the star-studded Corey Finley movie, Bad Education. He made Thoroughbreds. And there's like way too many people that I can remember off the top of my head in this movie, but
Ray Romano and Hugh Jackman, the dream team.
We've all been waiting. It's going to be a busy fall.
Yay. Good movies.
Get your rest now. Okay, go back to
Comic-Con.
Go back to Comic-Con and give us a dispatch.
We have to go back.
I just got back from Comic-Con. I haven't been to San Diego Comic-Con in 7 years.
Wow.
And I left, you know, I thought that would be the last time I ever went. But I got to say, I had a pretty good time at Comic-Con for being one of the more exhausting things you can possibly do with your time over like 4 days and getting no sleep and then taking a red eye right back home and collapsing. All that considered, San Diego Comic-Con, I think it's getting better. 7 years ago, I waited in the Hall H line to see the Hobbit panel, the Django Unchained panel, the Warner Brothers panel where Zack Snyder introduced Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice. It was actually a big event. And then there was a Marvel panel, of course, and it was spectacular. It was not worth waiting in Hall H for like 8 hours. But now I'm a privileged journalist and I got passes to go to
Hall H. Comic-Con's getting better because your access is getting better.
Well, I will say this. There are a lot fewer big like movie studio panels this year. There's more television. That's kind of been the direction Comic-Con's been going probably since I last went. It's scaled down. I mean, there's a bazillion people still. But just if you've ever gone to Comic-Con or you've wondered why anyone would ever go, it's pretty well organized. There's like thousands of people, but they do an amazing job. They take over San Diego, but they're moving lines and the panels are so organized. And it is really an efficient, it's like a film festival like efficiency to Comic-Con now. And I can appreciate that. But the real question, Dave, what reached the geekosphere this year at Comic-Con? Because when you're in deep, it's kind of like that scene in Interstellar where I went down to the planet and then I came home and my child was 36. and I so much time passed and I couldn't tell.
Does
what
Eleanor
actually
have the Jack disease?
No, it's called the relativity. Come on. Yeah, it was hard to tell exactly what mattered to people, if there was enough like news, if there was enough fervor. The thing that's always going to be genuine about Comic-Con is that the people who go, and I would never be this person, I would never go for fun. And that's not a slam on the people who do. The people who go truly love the shit that they want to either like buy the merch for or wait in line for 3 hours. It's like going to Disneyland or Disney World. If you are okay waiting 5 hours to go to the Star Wars Galaxy's Edge park in Disneyland, that's the same like thinking that would allow you to wait in line for like a Funko of your favorite, I don't know, Teen Titan or something, right? People love this shit. And when you're in the room with them, it's fun. It really is. But I'm not sure if it's still a great press event or not. We got a lot out of it, but I think we can do a lot of it from home too, because at this point, studios will put their trailers up. It's more like an announcement for their big preview. And, you know, we just covered E3 at Polygon. We talked a little bit about it on the podcast before, and that is a trade event. That's an industry event. And it's like a half the size of Comic-Con, because Comic-Con is both a trade industry event, it's a fan event, it's like an activation event where it's a circus, you know, it's everything. It's so huge. But I'm not sure what reaches people on the outside, if it feels like it still matters in that way. It used to.
I mean, I think it does if you, I mean, obviously people will follow properties they like there. Now that there's fewer, you know, movie studios throwing in everything, you know, in one presentation, Marvel's sort of the main story there in terms of how the view from outside. But like this year, Star Trek panel was big in my social sphere, which I was not expecting. Like even beyond the people I know that I just like follow on Twitter or talk to because they watch Star Trek Discovery with me. But like, I think Picard's really working for CBS All Access as far as bringing in the old next generation geeks who are used to watching it on like syndicated cable and making them at least pay attention to a trailer. But I kind of like this trailer / reveal press conference approach to Comic-Con that I've adapted it to. Because I think that the last time I went was also that same year you went. But that year I was, I think, doing photos for Cinema Blend, and I was like, I would prefer not to do any panels. Because, yeah, it all seemed like a real hassle to get your physical self in there, to maybe hear like a lackluster Q&A, and to get basically a press release. And I'm not sure if that's changed, but I do, the things that I used to get worried about as like a person covering Comic-Con from afar is like if they show large chunks of footage, they, you know, have everybody shut down the cameras and they're like, we don't want any of this to like leak on YouTube. This is just for you and blah, blah, blah. And sometimes that would be the only thing that they would show from a movie or from a project. And I think that's like a really weird way to create word of mouth that created this whole like blogosphere, live tweeting, whatnot. But the whole like ability to easily live stream things sort of killed that. So that even now I could watch panels as they're going on, you know, various secret periscopes of people willing to be like kicked out. But I didn't this year because I feel like they finally met that balance between announcement and like internet releases plus giving somebody or giving the fans who actually showed up enough to feel like they, you know, earned something by showing up in Comic-Con.
But I would like, say, you know, they're striking an interesting balance because you're right. Like, you can just put the assets out and call it a day, or you can have a horrible panel where you know that the people showing up don't want to be there. The Game of Thrones panel, for instance.
Right. Why did they do that?
It was horrible. I mean, they couldn't get anybody, like the big names. Maisie Williams was the biggest name they had. And that would be fine if there were like good questions or if anyone wanted to answer a question or like be genuine or reflect. It was so prickly with the fans, and I caught wind of this because I was like tweeting quotes on the panel, and people were globbing on, Game of Thrones fans were globbing on to me and being like, fuck Benioff and Weiss. And like, it was just such a toxic feeling. Whereas the most successful panels at Comic-Con, I actually think that Marvel, and we should get to this in its own little section.
The Mad Men panel.
Yes, the Mad Men panel, where it was just people would not reveal anything still, even though the show's been over for years. They were just sitting there calling spoilers, Matthew Weiner. I was going to say that Marvel is particularly egregious. It's actually a really bad panel as far as having a great fan experience and having a conversation about the things that people love. It is truly just a press conference info dump and a rally. It's a MAGA rally is what I'm suggesting, where people get hype and they just continue drop titles. We'll get there in a second. But like the best panels at Comic-Con, why Comic-Con has value is when like the cast and crew of Westworld show up and they have a exclusive trailer or whatever, and that's going to go online. But here you get to hear people talk about like character and talk about technology and talk about what their show is really about and actually have this great panel, this great conversation, because there's meat on the bone there, whether you think so or not, there is. I'm here to tell you. But I was surprised that Netflix has figured this out more than other people. And it shouldn't surprise you because they're ahead of the curve. They're what people are demanding over and over again. And they have this Witcher show that's coming out. They're kind of like Game of Thrones type property. And that was a huge success in terms of being a panel, because the showrunner, this woman, Lauren, Lauren Schmidt, Hissrich, she is so smart and so eloquent and can get up on stage and talk about her vision for the show. And then you have this footage. There's a trailer that went out. It's grand. But you still have clips for the fans that are like, here's a woman monologuing, and here's fucking whatever his name is. Henry Cavill, like gushing over wanting to play this role, being really passionate. He talked about how he had chased down Lauren to get this role before there were even scripts. He just really wanted to fucking play Geralt of Rivia because he loves games. I mean, he does look pretty badass in the show. And he's so passionate, and you feel the energy in the room. And then when you start seeing exclusive stuff, it's like, this is the real deal. This is what the panels used to be and they really just are not anymore. And then you have something like the Russos holding court in Hall H, and it's the opposite of what we want. It is truly a victory lap, like bow down to me. I just directed Endgame. And it's like, there's no respect for
the fans. And that's the community movie or get the fuck off the stage.
Yeah, pretty much. So I felt like I went to a good balance of panels that the crowd had reverence for the property, and then that the people on the stage knew that the only reason they were there were because of the fans. I got to see Robert Kirkman, who created The Walking Dead, on stage, and his panel was just him walking out and doing a Q&A. It was marvelous. Like, he just abruptly ended The Walking Dead comic book, for people who don't know. And he took the stage. It was like, if you want to cuss me out, like, do it now.
Yeah, and that's perfect. It's perfect timing for him to pull that shit too. And he's like earned it to be like, go to the biggest comic convention and just be like, my panel is going to be entire questions because I can take that shit.
And he knows that the reason he got to 193 issues of this comic is because everyone sitting in that room loved the comic, and unlike Benioff and Weiss, could actually show up and like take the heat if people fucking hated him. But they didn't, because he would listen to them. And that's the like creator fan relationship that in this like hashtag fans age, hashtag don't spoil the endgame age, is like so diabolical and evil and toxic. Whereas it's still alive at Comic-Con, and I was really happy to see
Wait,
that.
Can I ask you a question? If you were in Benioff and Weiss's position, where you had finished this colossal pop cultural entity and yeah. the ending had been controversial, do you think that you would have submitted yourself to that kind of heat?
Well, I think you in wanted their a chance case, that they fans? Hadn't earned, like, no, you probably wouldn't show up because you hadn't done the work to converse with fans anyway. There's always been a hostile relationship, I think, between the creators of that show and the fans of that show.
And what you probably wouldn't have done was say you were going to go and then back out.
I think that is a huge issue. That yeah. shows a certain level of weakness. And then throw a bunch of your actors in front of people, too. Like, cancel the whole panel. Or
is
show
there
up.
Any chance that their scheduling issues were legitimate, though?
No. Nope.
Because yeah, Star Wars must be shooting tomorrow or something.
Let me
yeah.
tell you guys, every one of those people, including the showrunners, got asked by Con of Thrones what their rates were to show up at a convention. Huh. And some responded that they couldn't because their talent would be, you know, considering San Diego Comic-Con already. So all of those people, like, knew exactly what they were walking into and chose the giant clusterfuck convention, willingly.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with Comic-Con, too, is all the questions are screened. Again, this goes back to the like running it like a true machine. No one can get up to the microphone anymore. This is how it used to be. I mean, David, you used to go to Comic-Con all the time. I don't know if you ever saw like Bob Stenzel in Hall H or some shit going up and like cranking on people.
I have Bob Stenzel's phone number in my phone right now. We should call him.
I went karaoke with Bob Stenzel.
Me too. I was there.
It was a real treat. But that, those days are over, right? No one can go up to the microphone and be like, your show fucking sucked. You need to, they screen all the questions and they pick the people who are going to play safe, play ball. And you could invite real questions, but they don't. Whereas like Robert Kirkman, there's no censorship in that panel. People want to ask rich questions and good questions. So that was exciting. But maybe we should just wind down by talking about Marvel, because I feel like their panel in all of our worlds just imploded everything. There's just so
I was aware of the Marvel. I was aware of very little from Comic-Con, but I was aware of the Marvel panel.
Okay, it didn't reach the shores of South Carolina Lake, whatever you were.
I was in my house. I was at home watching anniversary moon landing coverage. Thank you very much. And everyone was like, Blade!
I was watching. I wasn't even at the Hall H. I was watching that tape of someone shitting on Tom Hanks.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, everyone
was screening in
that.
The ballroom 20 down the block. Yeah. For people who don't know, but they probably do, Marvel announced like 8,000 movies and shows for the next two. It's only the next 2 years, which is pretty incredible. I think it's four Disney Plus shows and five or six movies.
Five Disney Plus shows, five movies.
Yeah, that's wild.
And that is the sticking point. I think that more interesting than any of the actual individual movies that they announced was this, the first broadside in their attempt to sort of blur the line between a movie and a television show with Disney Plus.
Which is fascinating. I mean, if you are into the grand storytelling of Marvel, there's a lot of opportunities there. They're going to do a show with Scarlet Witch and Vision. That sounds just mad, like truly nerd madness.
The fact that it's called WandaVision just tickles me.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're going to grab from like House of M and Tom King's Vision books, if you're familiar with those, people listening. And they're going to do this whole like deconstructing, you know, Vision's dead after Endgame, and they're going to
spoil the Endgame. Jesus Christ.
Oh, damn it. I forgot about that hashtag. I'm such a bad hashtag fan. You know, they're going to reconstruct reality in the multiverse, and she's going to live in like 1950s, and Vision's going to wear a sweater vest again. It's going to be madness. And then, of course, it's going to go right into Doctor Strange 2, and like all of these become essential, and you can understand. You know, I was joking on Twitter this week in my post Comic-Con days that if people think there are too many superhero movies now, just like they should try reading comics. There's just so many stories, and like wrap your mind around that. But like, there's, I'm so back and forth on this. I really like the Marvel movies. We talk about a lot on the podcast, and we get a little frustrated that there's just so much, but we come off of a lot of these movies like, hey, that was actually pretty good. Or unless you're David and fucking hated Spider-Man and been so wrong, but then get a bunch of podcast listeners rallying behind you in our iTunes
reviews. Yeah.
Fuck those people. But no. Then, of course, I just feel this existential dread from the Disney monolith. Maybe it's because Lion King also came out the weekend of Comic-Con, where I'm just like, this fucking sucks.
It would have been something. Sucks. If not Disney, it would have been something else.
What do you mean?
I mean, this is post-capitalism, baby. It's all just going to slowly turn down to shit, and then we got to rebuild from the ashes. But, like...
Whoa.
Jesus
Christ.
If Disney wasn't the monolith, there would have been another monolith that sucked up Disney. I think it's inevitable that you wouldn't have felt like the Lion King Marvel thing in the year of our Lord 2019 somehow at, like, every convention.
I don't know if I agree that it was inevitable that a Disney-sized giant was going to emerge.
I mean, it wouldn't feel inevitable if Paramount had strengthened their relationship with Marvel and done... If Paramount had the Marvel universe with
it. If Ike Perlmutter had never been born.
And Fox still had a tighter grip on Lucasfilm. And then Disney
North
just...
North Korea never hacked Sony.
I mean, listen, Katie, this is something you mentioned either online or in the show notes or wherever about how as neat as it is to see Marvel's continuing to push towards diversity in their films, that it does sort of feel like... a marketing play, although I think it's fair game. I mean, like, I think there's a reason why that stuff sells, and it's because there's an appetite for it and people want to be seen. But I do think what's really cool about this press conference in that regard is that this was really the first time to see what a post Ike Perlmutter world looked like. It was really like he is everything that he touched is behind us now, and we can chart a new future, and this is what it looks like. And that was cool, even though I am very skeptical. Or I guess unconvinced about the need for more Blade content. The rest of it looked cool.
That's not even the next 2 years.
The Blade thing is at least like I give them so much credit for a true surprise. Like, as far as I know, nobody had this on their horizon at all. Like, and that's just like there's just so few surprises that can be unleashed on in like in a big situation like that. So good for them.
And that's extra exciting because like the Henry Cavill chasing Geralt in The Witcher, you know, here's Mahershala Ali winning an Oscar and then being like, my first call is to Kevin Feige. I want to play Blade and they're gonna make it happen. Like, at least you have someone who's energized by the property. This isn't plug and play. The days of how Blade started in the first place with Wesley Snipes, those movies are good, but like that's still we're making late 90s blockbusters with someone Wesley Snipes, but it's also based on Blade.
Someone posted the GIF of like when Wesley Snipes refused to open his eyes on the set of one of the Blade movies, and so they had to use CG to digitally make it look like he'd open his eyes, but the technology was not quite where it had to be. It looks insane. Wesley Snipes, what a guy.
Wesley Snipes on Blade sets are some of my favorite like actor, director. So, like apparently in like Blade Trinity, by the end of the movie, the director had to give him notes on post-it notes that he would amend in red and get back to the director. And then there was no second round of notes. Wesley's notes had to stick.
I did like listening to Stephen Dorff on Mark Maron's podcast recently talking about how he thought like that movie, which was his first real concession to Hollywood studio filmmaking, might kill his career, and then ended up being the thing that sort of launched his career in a big way. But he has a fun perspective on what that whole experience is like. I think they should bring Stephen Dorff back.
I would just like to know.
And Stephen Dorff together from True Detective. Oh my God.
If winning an Oscar means you get to just call Kevin Feige and pick your superhero movie, I really want to know what Olivia Colman picked, and I look forward to her entry into the MCU. Whatever the fuck she wants.
I thought she chimed in on this. I thought she wants to play a villain in the MCU. Yeah, people were getting her quotes on this. I mean,
also, very cool Simo Liu tweeting
calling his shot.
Wanted to talk about Shang-Chi, and now he is playing Shang-Chi.
Fucking rules. I mean, it's exciting to like, and then Chloe Zhao, who, if you've seen pictures of the panel, like the director of The Rider, she's given a lot of quotes in the last year that's like, yeah, I really want to make a big blockbuster. This is something I want to do, even though I've been little movies and intimate movies. And she just looked so happy on stage. And that's what the Marvel panel will always do, as press conferencey, as news bomby as it will get. If you are ever in Hall H for one of those panels, Katie, have you ever been?
Oh yeah. I was there the year that they brought all the Avengers on stage for the first time.
Yes,
like no one knew if like Mark Ruffalo wasn't confirmed until he walked out on
stage.
That was
like, we just watched the Super Bowl.
Yeah. That was, I mean, I didn't know shit about the Avengers at that point, and it was really exciting. Yeah.
Room is so exciting, and it's just exciting to see people be really happy about making all these movies when it feels so bleak in a certain cultural sense. But then you see the picture of every actor up there. It's like, Jesus, every single famous person is going to be in a Marvel movie by the end of time. When Angelina doing this.
The Chloe Zhao thing is also a really fun, like, it feels like an antidote, not just to like the Colin Trevorrow era, where if you made one successful Sundance movie and you were a white guy, you got to have a franchise. Like, and there's a diversity element to that, but also like those guys, like maybe some of them really wanted to make a superhero movie. Like maybe a lot of them didn't and just felt like they had to, but that idea of like, not just like, we need a woman, we guess we got to find someone to make a movie to get, you know, get the quota. But finding people who really want to do it. Like there's a reason that she's doing it. And what Lucretia Martel, who was like asked to direct a Black Widow movie and was like, no, thank you, I'd like to make my own action scenes. Like good for them.
Right. Although the Lucretia Martel thing will always be the strangest bit.
The fact that they went
Marvel
to her at all.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like, have you seen a Lucretia Martel movie? Like, what are you thinking?
I think they were going to get Andrea Arnold originally. And
What do you guys think was the conversation that got Natalie Portman to agree to be in a Thor movie?
You get to be fucking Thor?
Billions of dollars.
Really, really thought her feud with Marvel was gonna last. Like I thought that she was like over it and didn't need it, and she still doesn't need it. I'm just like, I wonder if it was Taika. I wonder if it was $25 billion.
I'll take an educated guess on this. Kevin Feige said to Taika, if you want to do this, you have to do it yourself, but I give you carte blanche to give her anything she wants.
Natalie Portman won't speak to me, but maybe she'll speak to you.
Basically. And then he rolls up to a thing off of Thor Ragnarok, and he's like, look at what I did with your boring Kenneth Branagh Shakespearean property characters. I could do that for you, and I'll let you do whatever you want.
Sure.
I also think it's entirely possible that the reports about, you know, her disinterest in, I mean, there's a big difference between I don't want to fly to wherever the fuck and do a day on set for this silly Endgame scene and fuck you, Marvel, forever. You know, like, I think that sometimes we trust too much in the gossip that we turn into fact because everyone wants Hollywood to be a giant soap opera. And the fact is that they were probably like, hey, do you want to do this movie? You get to be Thor. And she was like, yeah, great.
I did junket interviews for the second Thor and sensed her agony, but also everyone's in agony at junket interviews. So,
and it was Thor too. I mean, it was not a great situation. Who would want to be in the sequel other than Chris Hemsworth? But yeah, she gets to play Thor in this. I mean, she's done a tremendous job of like being a powerful entity in Hollywood, and I don't think any other major blockbuster is going to, you know, hire her to be the hero. So come back to this and fucking wield Mjolnir.
Well, I think it's going to be awesome for her. Now, what I'm interested in is this like a, isn't it cool we made friends with Natalie Portman? She's like, yeah, I'll do this for some time. Or does she become the Thor that needs to be slotted in the new version of Avengers like 3 years down the line?
I'll tell you exactly what it's going to be. She gets to be Thor in Thor Love and Thunder. And then there's going to be an Avengers movie where there will have to be a shot of all the female heroes running towards Thanos 2. And she'll like pop out of nowhere for a cameo. And we'll all be like, oh, my God.
Thanos too, Super Thanos. Aside from all the hearsay of what might have been her relationship with Marvel, I do, and maybe Dave, you know, can speak to this with more authority, I can't imagine that they would sign her up for this without signing a multi-picture contract that she is going to be obligated, if she wants to be Thor and Thor Love and Thunder, to show up in.
Well, I mean, the Jane Foster arc has an ending built into it, is what I'll say without spoiling all of the comics. So it is possible to do a one-off if that's part of her deal, which is why I'm interested in seeing going forward. Because can you imagine a world where our second Avengers team, like Benedict Cumberbatch, is the least famous person in like that team of like new Avengers. It'd be
he's insane. Already the least famous person definitely. In any team of Avengers.
But I mean, but he's the one that's like probably going to be on whatever the new team's going to be, you know, and like maybe Tom Holland, Spider-Man or whatever. But like now the other ones could be like Angelina Jolie, Selma Hayek, Natalie Portman, Scarlet Witch.
Something we should flag for a future conversation is how Benedict Cumberbatch feels like he's lost all heat in his career. Like no one cares anymore. Yeah. I just don't
bizarre.
Care.
It's bizarre.
I'm like, you brought him up and I'm like, suddenly got mad.
I mean, he and Channing Tatum need to have a sit down and figure out where everything went wrong.
Might be right, but like
I love Channing Tatum, but things have really cooled down for him.
Okay, let's wrap up talking about Comic-Con. I am exhausted, but there was a lot
Tatum
of
have a Marvel movie?
There. He was supposed to have Gambit.
Yeah, he's supposed to be Gambit, but not anymore.
Damn. Okay. Comic-Con.
Comic-Con, you were good, but the best trailer was Watchmen, and they didn't have a panel.
Which is fine.
Watchmen looks good.
Also, no one booed Chris Hardwick.
Oh, weird. Weird to have him back. Weird.
He didn't get to come back from Marvel, so that was something.
Yeah, but it's like, I think that would have really cast a dark shadow over all of that. And respect to Marvel for putting their money where their mouth is in terms of these progressive issues and being more representative in whether it's the heartbeat bill in Georgia, which they're dealing with, or not wanting to entertain a Chris Hardwick. But like, I mean, is there really no other person that can moderate a fucking panel? I mean, who gives a shit? They're not there.
Everybody hosts Talking Dead, Dave.
Oh my god.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We will be back next week. I believe the plan is to talk about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, if you're wondering what happened there. Woo. Shout out to all of you people who don't get a chance to see things until they open.
Woo.
I'll see you in movies this weekend. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches. I am a senior editor at Polygon, and I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. And we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes, you can share them with friends, and I want to also plug Polygon's podcast, speaking of our Comic-Con coverage, because we had our like own mini Comic-Con, I forgot to mention this, off-site, where we interviewed Gendy Tartakovsky and Rebecca Sugar, the creator of Steven Universe, and those interviews are going to run, they're hour-long interviews with these creators, and they're fabulous, and they're going to run on the Polygon Show podcast feed, so I gotta plug that.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. Please find all of our Best of the Decade coverage on IndieWire.com. I don't care if you feel like it's too early. It's still fun to read through. And hopefully, even if you look at it, through down your nose and thumbing your nose, whatever the expression is, there are a lot of movies on there that you can add to your watch list for when you make your far more authoritative Best of the Decade list in 6 months. Fill in those gaps. Please also leave us a review on iTunes at Fighting in the War Room. We'll read it on the show.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. I am on Twitter at DA70. I'm also on something called The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast, where we are rewatching Lost. This week, I also appear on another podcast called Talk Me Into. Patches, I think you might like this show. It's a podcast where one friend tries to talk another two friends into some sort of pop culture thing. I initially picked up their show because they did it. A podcast episode about Animorphs, and I was tweeting at them as one of the people that remembers Animorphs, and this week they had me on to try to talk two of them into Lost who had never seen it before. So if for some reason you don't want to join us on the Storm Lost Rewatch podcast, check out this week's Talk Me Into, where I try to talk some people into Lost.
And I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at vanityfair.com. This week on Local Men, we talked more about the Toronto lineup, so you can hear me say some of the same things I said on this, and then more of them. You can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KATEYRICH, and we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where you can explain the Marvel Cinematic Universe to me, or you can answer this week's lightning round question, which was,
in honor of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, what's your favorite moment in a movie where a character from real life shows up?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week. Before it's too